The summer people had yet to arrive, so they would have the place virtually to themselves for confidential conversation. It was a stunner of a day. The kind of day that promised more days exactly like it, for months to come. The hostess led Grace and Madeline across the grass to the premium outdoor table for two, with an uninterrupted view of the harbor and the huge summer homes in Monomoy. The waitress handed them menus, and Grace said, "We'll have a very cold bottle of Sancerre, if you have it." Madeline regarded her menu. "Definitely worth giving up work for," she said. "I love it here. You are so lucky." Grace knew she was lucky. She and Eddie had languished on the wait list at the Nantucket Yacht Club for years before Grace realized that they would never get in. She supposed Eddie had pissed too many people off, or possibly the old Nantucket families who belonged there didn't want a man nicknamed Fast Eddie to join their ranks. But then the great Harbor Yacht Club opened, and Eddie jumped at the opportunity. He was one of the first people to write a check for the six-figure initiation fee. Grace studied the menu. Oysters on the half-shell, grilled Caesar salad with creamy Roquefort dressing, lobster club sandwich with shoestring fries, and tried to make herself feel hungry. The waitress came with the wine, which Grace tasted and approved. The waitress poured two glasses, then set the bottle in a bucket of ice. Grace and Madeline touched glasses, and Grace said, "Thank you for making me do this." Madeline said, "Thank you for buying lunch." They laughed. But a short moment later, the waitress came back with an uneasy expression on her face. She leaned over to Grace and said, "I'm sorry to interrupt your drinks, but I just found out from our general manager that accounting hasn't received your check for this year's dues, so technically I'm not allowed to serve you." "What?" Grace said. She reached for her phone to text Eddie. He handled all their bills. But cell phones were verboten at Great Harbor. She smiled at the waitress. "I have two ideas. One is I could just pay you cash for lunch, and then we can clear up the missing dues check later. I'm sure my husband sent it, or he meant to send it, but he's got a lot going on at the moment with his business." Grace wondered if the invoice for the yacht club had gotten mixed up with some of the bills for the spec houses. Or possibly he had left the bill for Eloise to pay and she had forgotten. She was getting older and tended to let things slip. Grace had encouraged him to replace her, but as Eddie pointed out, she was related to half the island. He couldn't just fire her. "I'm sorry," the waitress said. "I can't accept any cash." "Okay," Grace said. "How about if I write you the check for the dues right now, and then if you find my husband's check, or if it comes in the mail, you can tear it up?" "I'll ask the manager about that," the waitress said. She left to do so, and Grace pulled her checkbook out. She rolled her eyes at Madeline. "I can't believe Eddie," she said. "I'm totally mortified." "Please," Madeline said. "I'm your best friend. I wish I could help." The waitress reappeared. "Our manager said that would be fine." "Okay," Grace said. "Good. How much is it?" $15,000, the waitress said. Grace wrote the check out, feeling Madeline's eyes on her. $15,000? Back when Grace and Eddie had just met Madeline and Trevor, they would go for dinner on Saturday nights and split the bill. Madeline later admitted to Grace that the cost of the meal weighed on her mind every second, to the point where she almost couldn't enjoy her food. What had they ordered? How much had the wine cost? Eddie always chose it. Did they have enough cash, or would they have to pile it onto their credit cards, which were already sagging like a rained-on roof? "Oh," Grace had said. She'd had no idea Madeline felt that way. If she'd known, she would have encouraged Eddie to pay each and every time. But Eddie wouldn't have liked that. He was a naturally frugal person, a result of having grown up dirt poor, living over a dry cleaner's in downtown New Bedford. If he paid every time, he might argue what would happen to the Llewellyn's pride. Now Grace wondered what Madeline was thinking. Thankfully, the waitress vanished with the check and the issue was over. Madeline said, "What's going on with Benton?" Grace didn't have anything to describe except her longing. "No, Grace, I'm not leaving you forever." But what if he was? What if he got back in touch with McGovey, called her up in San Diego, and convinced her somehow to come back to Nantucket? Grace had stood at her window and waited for Benton's truck to appear in her driveway every morning. She took care of the chickens because they would starve without her, but the rest of the garden she'd ignored, because she just couldn't make herself cut back the roses or wipe their leaves with lemon water. She couldn't deadhead the perennial bed. She couldn't even mow the lawn, and that was her favorite task. She said, the morning it happened, he started talking to Hope about the books he'd read that he thought she would enjoy, and it killed me. He became this other person. There I was, standing in front of my daughter, and with every book he mentioned, I fell more and more in love. Grace, Madeline said, you are not in love. I know you think you are, but you're in love with Eddie and your girls. Grace sipped her wine and looked out over the flat, blue surface of Nantucket Sound. You're right, she said. But Madeline wasn't right. Three glasses of wine had turned Grace's attitude around. When she and Madeline parted ways in the parking lot, Grace said, thank you for listening. Madeline said, that's what I'm here for. Madeline pulled out of the parking lot toward home, toward her perfect marriage to Trevor and their shared adoration of brick. Grace decided to call Eddie and let him know about the yacht club dues, but she was shuttled right to his voicemail, and when Grace called the office, which she was loath to do because she really didn't want to talk to Eloise or Barbie, and those two screened Eddie's calls like he was the CEO of Microsoft, she got the recording. She stared at her phone. The wine was coursing through her veins. She imagined it taking her good sense with it. My phone is always on. As she texted Benton, the tops of her ears started to buzz. Will you come tomorrow and have lunch? Just friends. Promise. Noon? She decided she would not move from the yacht club parking lot until he texted back. If she was there at midnight, so be it. But he texted back right away. I'll be there. She was in the gardening shed, scrubbing the copper farmer's sink, when Benton came strolling around the house. Hey, she called out. I'm in here. Benton stepped through the door and said, you're a sight for sore eyes. Grace laughed. It's only been 4 days. He walked over to her, and his hands went immediately on her hips. Because it was so hot, she was wearing only a bikini top and a pair of shorts. Are the girls at school? He asked. She grinned. Safely at school. And Eddie? Work, she said. His mouth met her mouth. His tongue met her tongue, which made Grace feel as if she were going to faint or die. The kissing was sweet at first, and then incendiary. The gardening shed was hot, hot, hot to begin with, but once she was kissing Benton, they were both sweating and pulsing with insane desire. He closed and locked the door and then lifted Grace up onto the lip of the sink. With a couple of deft movements, he untied her bikini top and pulled off her shorts, and then he knelt before her. Later, they ate lunch. Grace served a cold roast chicken, a fresh head of butter lettuce, a crock of herbed farmer's cheese, and fat, rosy radishes pulled from the garden. She cut thick slices of bread from a seeded multigrain loaf with a nice chewy crust. Then she went back into the fridge and pulled out sweet butter, a jar of baby gherkins, a stick of summer sausage, and some whole grain mustard. A plowman's lunch, Benton said, like the ones I used to have in Surrey. I'm glad you like it, Grace said. I like everything about you, he said. You are not in love. Benton helped Grace carry everything to the teak table outside, and they sat down with their feast within full sight of the garden. Together they dug in, piecing together bites for each other. Radish, sweet butter, and mustard, a slice of bread spread thick with farmer's cheese and topped with sausage. Grace's hands were shaking as she fed him. He nibbled at the tips of her fingers. He said, do you know the song, Loving Cup, by the Rolling Stones? He started to sing, I'm the plowman in the valley with a face full of mud. Did she? She said, I think so. Here, he said, I'll play it. He plugged his phone into the outdoor speaker, and music filled the backyard. Benton took Grace's hand and pulled her to her feet. They started to slow dance to the song right there on the deck, Benton's arms around Grace, Grace's face resting on Benton's chest. She hadn't even known such happiness existed. What a beautiful buzz. What a beautiful buzz. When Benton left, Grace ran up to her study. She needed to call Madeline. Madeline. The apartment, which had seemed so freeing to Madeline initially, now felt like a jail cell. Madeline had to drag herself there, and when she walked in, she experienced something like panic. She had paid $12,000 for the place, and now she needed to make it earn its keep. Pressure. She couldn't write a word under such pressure. She had no ideas for another novel, not one. She was plagued with all kinds of upsetting thoughts. They were running out of money. She had promised more than she could deliver. They should never have invested the $50,000 with Eddie. Trevor would have to ask for it back, since Madeline's plea had done no good. She was past her deadline, the deadline Red Dreyfus had extended for her. Red had called her cell phone and left two exasperated messages, and both Angie and Angie's assistant, Marlowe, emailed and then called. They needed the copy, otherwise she would be bumped from the list and there would be financial repercussions. Madeline capitulated. She had no choice. She would write a sequel to Islandia. But when Madeline sat down with her legal pad and began an outline, the book she described wasn't a sequel to Islandia. The book she described was a hot, steamy love affair between a stay-at-home mother of two and her contractor. I am not writing this, Madeline thought. I am not writing this. But she was writing it. The words were flowing out of her like something she spilled on the page. Grace had said it herself. Everything was normal and boring, and now my life is a novel. Madeline didn't even commit to giving her two lovers names. She called them B and G. The male protagonist, B, is the project manager of the female protagonist's home renovation. The female protagonist, G, is a stay-at-home mother of two girls, Irish twins, born 11 months apart. B and G start conferring every day on the renovation. Did G want an undermounted porcelain sink in the kitchen or a double stainless steel? What kind of countertops? Granite? Limestone? Corian? Backsplash of decorative tile or plain drywall? What kind of hardwood flooring? Maple? Cherry? Antique knotty pine? What style for the cabinets? What kind of cabinet pulls? B and G end up kissing for the first time in the first floor powder room during a discussion of fixtures for the sink. The quarters are tight and dark, as the electrician has yet to come hang the lights. G is in the powder room when B walks in, and they accidentally bump hips. The next thing either of them knows, they are passionately kissing. B starts bringing G Moroccan mint tea every day, as well as a box of four pistachio macarons from the local bakery, which they would share. Madeline didn't even bother changing the kind of cookie. She supposed she could have made them white chocolate meltaways or peanut butter truffles. She could have changed the Moroccan mint tea to an iced vanilla latte. I am not writing this. I am not writing this. She couldn't turn this in. Grace would sue her, or kill her, or both. But it was good. Madeline could see that it was good. It was spare and compelling. Grace's affair with Benton Coe did contain all the elements of good fiction. Loneliness, desire, sex, betrayal. B and G fall deeper and deeper in love as work on the house progresses. G's husband, a real estate attorney named Wren, short for Renfrew, pays all the bills, including the astronomical bill for B's services, without complaint. He tells people he's happy that his wife is happy. Madeline wrote one sample scene, and that was the scene of the two lovers eating a plowman's lunch on the sunny deck. They feed each other. B nibbles on G's fingertips, and then they slow dance to Loving Cup by the Rolling Stones. Madeline couldn't even bring herself to change the song. Loving Cup was too perfect. She could not write this novel, but she had nothing else, and so she typed up the outline and added the sample scene and emailed them to Red Dreyfus with the subject line, "I tried." Eddie. He had a love-hate relationship with Memorial Day weekend. On the one hand, he couldn't wait for it to arrive, announcing, as it did, the start of summer. Eddie loved the summer as much as anyone on Nantucket. He loved it not because the shops and restaurants opened, not because the lifeguards in their red tank suits and trunks patrolled the beaches, not because the lilacs were blooming and the weather was finally warm enough for barbecues and wiffle ball games and outdoor showers. No, Eddie loved summer because summer meant the steamship was low in the water, the martini and oyster-seeking crowds milled outside of crew, a line formed at the chicken box to hear the band Max Stone, The parking lot of the Stop and Shop was filled to capacity, with people illegally parked in the handicapped spots, and the traffic on Orange Street made the year-rounders shout profanities at their dashboards. Summer on Nantucket meant people, and people meant money, the buying and selling of houses, the renting of vacation weeks. However, Memorial Day on Nantucket also meant Figowie, a Nantucket tradition that only grew bigger and more obnoxious every year. It was, ostensibly, a sailing race from Hyannis to Nantucket and back again. The genesis of the name was everyone's favorite fact about the weekend. One year, while sailing in dense fog, some old salt called out, "Hey, where the Figowie?" And in this way, the race was named, because really, who doesn't love sanctioned profanity? Figowie Weekend had morphed in recent years from a sailing race to a drinking race. It was a contest of who could drink the most, who could drink the fastest, who could stay up drinking the latest, who could get up the earliest and start drinking, who could act like the biggest jerk. This was the nicest term Eddie could come up with, although he had dozens at his disposal, while drinking. Figowie was popular with the post-collegiate crowd, kids who had just graduated from Hamilton or Bowdoin or Middlebury or Eddie's least favorite, Boston College. "How do you know if somebody went to BC?" he liked to quip. "They'll tell you." These kids now had jobs in Manhattan or Boston as editorial assistants or Wall Street grunts or preschool teachers, or they were in law school at NYU or medical school at Harvard. They lived in apartments in the West Village or the Back Bay that their parents still paid for, but in general they were trying to be adults. They met for drinks after work on Newbury Street or in Soho. They skipped church on Sundays and brunched instead, and on summer weekends they went away. Figowie Weekend on Nantucket was made for them. The men wore their faded red shorts from Murray's. They tied cable-knit sweaters around their necks. They wore sunglasses inside because they were so dreadfully hungover. The girls, or rather women, paraded around in patio dresses without underwear. They all thought they were Diane von Furstenberg by the Beverly Hills Hotel pool in 1973. And they all carried handbags that seemed to contain as much crap as a 30-gallon hefty bag. Eddie wanted to tell them that they could go on Let's Make a Deal with all the stuff they had in their purses, but they would have had no idea what he was talking about. Certain women, however, wore outfits that looked like they'd been stolen from the trailer park clothesline. Cut-off jean shorts and tight t-shirts that said, "Sorry for partying." The women irked Eddie more than the men, probably because he had daughters. If the weather was sunny, the Figowians, truly their own nation, funneled down Hummock Pond Road in their rental jeeps with cases of Bud Light in the back. The beaches were patrolled by rent-a-cops on ETVs who had a field day issuing tickets for public consumption and littering. The red-suited lifeguards pulled people out of the ocean left and right because the riptide was notoriously bad in May. And no matter how educated these young bucks were, bucks substituted for dozens of other terms Eddie had at his disposal, they didn't seem to know that the way to get out of the rip was to swim parallel to shore until the grip of the waves let them go. But this year, there was rain. Rain on Figowie Weekend was 1,000 times worse than sun on Figowie, because the activities of beaching and drinking were replaced by drinking and drinking. The epicenter of Figowie drinking was always the Straight Wharf, specifically the tavern, the gazebo, the eponymous Straight Wharf restaurant, and crew. These restaurants were bursting at their seersucker and madras seams with screaming, laughing, swearing, hiccuping, posturing nouveau adults who were only just learning how to appreciate a good Bloody Mary and suck down an oyster without dripping onto their Brooks Brothers. Eddie wasn't sure what made him decide to head down to crew at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. He realized it was going to be a blender. This was the nicest word he could come up with, though he had dozens of others at his disposal. Barbie refused to leave her house during Figowie Weekend. She never told Eddie exactly what she did at home, but if he had to guess, he would say that when it was sunny, she sat on her back deck and drank prickly pear margaritas. And if it rained, she indulged her lifelong crush on James Garner and watched old episodes of The Rockford Files. Eddie supposed if he had to name what truly motivated him, he would say he wanted to be where the action was. Someday these Figauians would grow up to be attorneys and surgeons, college presidents, NFL coaches, and of course, hedge fund managers. In 5 years, many of these Figauians would be married, with a toddler on the ground and a baby on the way, and looking for a rental, 1 week, then 2 weeks, then the month of July, then the summer. In 10 years, these Figauians would be ready to buy. So basically, Eddie thought, the drink he was about to have was an investment in his pre-retirement years. He bypassed the gazebo, even though a rumor was circulating that two defensemen from the Boston Bruins were snuggled up against the bar in the midst of that dense, black hole of humanity. How did people breathe in there? He wondered. How did they find room to bring their drinks to their mouths without elbowing someone in the jaw? He bypassed the Straight Wharf restaurant, although he liked it there. They served excellent bluefish pâté, and the restaurant attached to the bar was some of the finest dining on Nantucket. But Eddie wouldn't touch it with a 10,000-foot pole this weekend. Even as he passed, he saw two young bucks holding a girl in a white strapless sundress by her ankles over the side of the balcony. She was screaming, "Put me down! Damn it, Leo! Put me down! I'm going to puke! I'm going to puke!" Eddie slowed down to see if the young lady would in fact puke, or better still, if her breasts would pop out of her dress, or if the young bucks would lose their grip on her ankles and drop her head first into the bushes. "I see London, I see France," one of the bucks said, looking down the girl's skirt. "I'm going to puke, Leo," she screamed, and a split second later she did, and Eddie checked his watch. 5 minutes after two and the puking had begun. Eddie headed down to Crewe. Crewe was upscale. The crowd was marginally older and more moneyed. 3 years earlier, Eddie had happened across the owner of 10 Low Beach Road at the back bar at Crewe, and that was where the deal for Eddie to rent the house had been struck. "Do you think you can get $50K?" the owner had asked. "I don't think I can," Eddie had said. "I know I can." "I like the confidence of that statement," the owner had said. In the back of his mind, Eddie was hoping for similar luck from this outing. He needed something big, something legal. Financially, he didn't feel that much different from the girl hanging upside down, desperate, about to lose every shred of dignity. The deal with Deepwell had gone so smoothly that Barbie had volunteered to call certain other groups renting Low Beach Road and offer the same scenario. 5 beautiful Russian women, 10,000 per night. Eddie couldn't believe how ballsy his sister was. He would be terrified to propose the idea to anyone, but he realized that the arrangement sounded better coming from a woman. Eddie had overheard Barbie in action on the phone. She was equal parts Barbara Eden, from I Dream of Jeannie, granting these men their wildest wishes, and Israeli special ops soldier, a person not to be messed with. To Eddie, she said, "If they turn me down, they turn me down. I pretend I never mentioned it." But so far, nobody had turned her down. Every corporate group wanted in. That very evening, a mining concern from West Virginia was checking in, and they were gung-ho for the girls. And the girls? Well, the girls were ecstatic. Eddie was grateful for the cash, but there was a trade-off. He had chronic heartburn, and it was difficult to sleep at night. He constantly worried that someone was watching him. But he needed the money. Grace had written a $15,000 check to the Great Harbor Yacht Club, which had bounced. "Bounced?" Grace had said when he told her. "What is going on, Eddie? I thought maybe it was Eloise's fault. I thought it was an administrative glitch." He said, "The spec houses are taking all my spare funds, Grace. We might have to take a hiatus year from the yacht club until I sell them." Grace gave him an incredulous look. "You're telling me we don't have 15 grand for the yacht club?" "That's what I'm telling you." "But when you say the check bounced, it makes it sound like we don't even have 15,000 in our account." Eddie cleared his throat. He was not enjoying this conversation one bit. "We do not, presently, have $15,000 in our account." "How is that possible?" Grace said. "The spec houses are eating me alive," Eddie said. "Can't you just sell one unfinished?" Grace asked. "That's a possibility," Eddie said. "Or we can be patient and wait until I sell a house." "Do you have any irons in the fire?" Grace asked. He smiled. "Always." "Okay," Grace said. She took a deep breath. "I can survive the summer without the yacht club." Eddie was relieved. Occasionally, in anger, he accused Grace of being spoiled because she had grown up with so much money. But the truth was, Grace was as level-headed a woman as he had ever met. "Thank you for being understanding," Grace said. "You still have money to pay Benton, though, right, and Hester Phan?"
"Right,"
Eddie said, uncertainly. Hester was the publicist who was supposed to get their garden into a magazine. The only reason Eddie had agreed to sponsor that effort was because he thought the potential article might reflect well on him as a real estate agent. The spec houses were in danger. Eddie had taken his cash from Deepwell and paid his plumber and Jerry for half the foundation of number 13. As for Madeline and Trevor's money, well, he didn't know how to handle that situation. He needed to sell a house. The beautiful brunette owner of Crewe was standing at the podium when Eddie walked in. Eddie had known her since she landed on the island, straight out of the University of Richmond. She greeted him with a nice hug and said, "You're not going to believe this, Eddie, but I have one stool available at the back bar. Are you alone?"
"I'm alone," he said, then wondered if he should feel embarrassed by this. Nobody celebrated Fugawi alone. It went against the very nature of Fugawi, which was all about getting shit-faced en masse and living out stories that no one could ever quite remember, but that could be fudged and embellished for years to come. To venture out on Fugawi weekend alone screamed loserdom, or so Eddie worried.
The bartender, a young woman who used to babysit for Eddie's twins, said, "Hey, Eddie, what can I get you?" He couldn't remember his former babysitter's name. It was in the Elisa, Alyssa, Alicia vein, but he wasn't sure exactly which. Grace would know. Grace would also probably know the girl's middle name. But if Eddie texted her to ask, he would receive a response sometime next month because Grace never checked her cell phone. He was disappointed in himself. He was a real estate agent. It was his business to remember names. "I'll have a..." He wasn't sure what he wanted. Around him, the drink of choice seemed to be the Bloody Mary, but drinking a Bloody would immediately give Eddie heartburn. He was getting heartburn just looking at the Bloody belonging to the man next to him. "I'll have a 888 martini, straight up with a twist, please." "You know who invented the twist, right?" asked the man next to him. "It was John D. Rockefeller. He was a germaphobe, and citrus was a natural disinfectant. So Rockefeller always asked his bartenders to run a lemon peel around the rim of his glass." Eddie turned to the man. "I did not know that," he said. But such nuggets of trivia were always of great use to him. He would use that tidbit the next time he took a client out for drinks. As soon as that thought formed, Eddie realized that the man next to him was not just a man. It was Ed Kapanash, the chief of police.
"Whoa, Chief!"
"How you doing, Eddie?" the chief said with a smile. He and Eddie shook hands, and when Elisa, Alyssa, Alicia set down Eddie's martini, they touched glasses with great camaraderie. The chief was here at Crewe. Eddie could not have been more surprised if he'd bumped into the chief in some foreign location. A bar in Hong Kong, or a cafe in Amsterdam. He wondered if the chief was following him. But again, the chief had been here first. This was merely a coincidence.
"What are you doing here?"
Eddie asked. The chief was deeply incognito. He was wearing a navy polo shirt, a pair of khaki shorts, and the red Mount Gay Rum Fugawi baseball hat that announced one's participation in the festivities. Eddie lowered his voice. "Are you undercover?" The chief threw his head back and laughed, which in turn made Eddie laugh. The chief sucked down what was left of his Bloody Mary and ordered another from their bartender, whom he called Elisa.
"Elisa.
I came down to check on the guys, see how they're doing, even though I'm off duty today," the chief said. "Everyone assumes I hate this weekend, but everyone is wrong. I'm a sailor myself. I enjoy the energy."
Eddie nodded and laid into his drink, which had been perfectly made by his former babysitter, Elisa. Immediately, his mood improved.
"I don't mind it either," Eddie said. "And I enjoyed that story about Rockefeller. History always was my best subject."
"Oh, yeah?" the chief said. "Mine, too. I done a bunch of reading about Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Mellon, all the big industrialists."
Eddie said, "I wonder what future generations will say about us. I'm pretty sure they'll call us the cell phone era."
At that very moment, Eddie's cell phone rang.
His ringtone was Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple, which made the chief chuckle.
"That right there is the first and only song I ever learned to play on the guitar," he said.
Eddie checked his display. It was Nadia calling, probably to find out what time the girls should be at the house tonight. Eddie's skin grew hot and prickly. He silenced his phone, slipped it into his pocket, and took another swill of his drink.
"I forgot you were a sailor," Eddie said.
He would call Nadia on his way back to the office. He obviously couldn't say one word to her while he was sitting next to the chief of police.
"I haven't sailed in 6 years," the chief said, "since Greg and Tess McAvoy."
"Oh, God," Eddie said. "Right. I'm so sorry I wasn't thinking." The chief picked up his bloody and rattled the ice, then added a shot of Tabasco, squeezed the lemon wedge, and stirred it up with his celery stick.
"It's okay," the chief said. "Greg and I used to sail Fagawi every year. It was a tradition for us. I guess the real reason I come down here is to honor those memories. We always came here for a drink when we were done, back when it was the rope walk. Bloody Marys and a dozen little necks apiece."
Eddie finished off his drink and signaled Elisa for another. Eddie wasn't sure how they had landed on such a maudlin topic, but he felt it was his fault and he wanted to make it right. When Elisa delivered his second martini, he held it up.
"To Greg McAvoy," he said.
The chief nodded solemnly as he and Eddie clinked glasses again, but the chief seemed too overcome for words. The chief, Eddie realized in that moment, was just a human being, like the rest of them. He wasn't here to sting Eddie. He was a guy who had lost his best friend and was still mourning.
"Greg had his flaws," the chief finally said, "but I loved him like a brother. It's 6 years later and I still can't believe he's gone. Sometimes when it's just me and the cruiser and I'm out late, either on rounds or headed for home, I can hear him laughing."
"I'm going to tell you something pathetic," Eddie said. "I've never had a friend like that."
"You're friends with Trevor Llewellyn," the chief said. "Right? You guys do stuff together all the time."
"That's not really the same thing," Eddie said. And it wasn't. Eddie and Trevor got along great. They had fun together. They occasionally had what Eddie thought of as real conversations, but almost always these conversations concerned their wives or children. There was no lasting bond between Eddie and Trevor. Eddie hadn't seen Trevor since dinner a couple of weeks earlier, and it was no big deal to Eddie, just as Eddie was sure it was no big deal to Trevor. Trevor was flying his planes, going about his daily business, just as Eddie was.
"Trevor and I hang out, drink, smoke cigars, but honestly, that friendship is primarily powered by our wives. I would say the friendship you had with Greg was probably pretty rare."
"I'll agree with that," the chief said.
"Where did you grow up, Eddie?"
"New Bedford," Eddie said. "Downtown?"
"Mean streets," the chief said, "at least as I understand it."
"I guess so," Eddie said. "My parents did the best they could. Then my old man died of emphysema when I was 14. Then my mother 3 years later of lung cancer. They both smoked like chimneys, and Barbie, too. I never touched cigarettes because I ran track."
"That's right," the chief said.
"Running kept me out of trouble," Eddie said. "I still hold the Commonwealth record for the 400.
"You don't say."
The chief ordered another drink, and Eddie felt pleased by this. It was as if the 300 other people in the bar had ceased to exist. He was hanging out and drinking and engaging in meaningful conversation with the chief of police. Maybe because Eddie had grown up in New Bedford, or maybe because Eddie's business had, for so many years, seemed so easy as to be illegal, or maybe because Eddie's conscience was aching, or maybe because he, Eddie, just like everyone else in the world, needed authentic human connection. His present circumstances seemed monumental.
"Would you like to order a couple dozen little necks?" Eddie asked. "I know I'm not Greg McAvoy, but I'm happy to help you eat them."
"Yes," the chief said. "I'd like that. I'd like that very much." Eddie flagged Elisa and ordered up the clams.
"Thank you," the chief said. "You're a good guy, Eddie. A really good guy."
At 5 o'clock, Eddie walked out of crew feeling like a changed man. Upright, clean, worthy, respectable. The chief had left 15 minutes earlier to get home to his wife and the McAvoy twins, Chloe and Finn, whom he was now raising. The chief had actually hugged Eddie goodbye and pounded him on the back. And they had exchanged cell phone numbers, the chief giving Eddie his super-secret number, which he was sure to answer any time of the day or night.
"If you ever need a hand or want to grab a drink," the chief said, "just call me."
"I'll do that," Eddie said, and then he laughed. Too loudly? Too eagerly? The four vodka martinis had him by the shoulders. The chief had had just as many drinks as Eddie, if not more. But he was a man who was unaffected by alcohol.
"I'll call you sometime to go fishing," the chief said. "I bought a boat last year, a 26-foot whaler, with a brand new 250. Do you like to fish?"
"I love to fish," Eddie said, although this was a lie. He hated to fish. It was too much sit around and wait for Eddie. He would rather be in the office making money. But if the chief wanted to go fishing, Eddie would go fishing. Trevor loved to fish and had belonged to the Anglers Club since he was 18. It occurred to Eddie that Trevor might be a better choice as a friend for the chief, but now Eddie was starting to sound like Grace.
"Great," the chief said. "Take care and enjoy the rest of your weekend."
"Okay, chief," he said. He felt sorrowful at the chief's departure.
"I would definitely like to go fishing. Call me."
The chief pointed at Eddie in a way that could have meant anything. And then he sliced his way through the intoxicated crowd, who all stepped aside for him because even if they didn't know he was the police chief, they sensed his authority. Now out on the straight wharf by himself, Eddie saw Fagawians stumbling and swaying. He saw potential fistfights brewing. He saw women losing their shoes and their hair ties and control of their bra straps. Walking back past the straight wharf restaurant, Eddie spied the girl in the white strapless sundress sitting on the railing, drinking a Corona. She had puked and rallied. Good for her. She saw him staring and waved at him. He walked quickly away. He was not going to lose this glow of virtue by flirting with someone half his age. But he was going to lose the glow of virtue. Yes, he was. He thought of the paper bag full of cash. He thought about how everyone on the staff at the Great Harbor Yacht Club now knew Eddie was in financial trouble. Soon other members would hear the rumor, and then there would be blood in the water. Glenn Daly, Eddie's archenemy, belonged to Great Harbor. He needed to sell a house. But until then, he had the girls. Madeline. Angie called, screaming. At first, Madeline thought it was angry screaming. But then she realized it was happy, joyful, excited screaming.
"I love it," she said. "I absolutely fucking love it."
Madeline was confused. "You love what?"
"Your new book," Angie said.
"Wait a minute," Madeline said. "How did you get it?"
"Red sent it to me," Angie said. "I read the sample scene. There is something in the writing that is so immediate, so electrifying, it nearly burned my fingers as I turned the page. Your characters have such hot chemistry. We're going to market it as the Playboy Channel meets HGTV. After all, what woman doesn't want to sleep with her contractor?"
Madeline was stunned silent. She had sent the outline and sample scene to Red because she'd wanted him to know that he hadn't cashed in his diamond-quality favor for her in vain. She had made a good-faith effort to come up with something else. She hadn't expected Red to forward it to Angie, and she certainly hadn't anticipated this kind of enthusiasm. "The Playboy Channel meets HGTV?"
"I want you to start writing as fast as you can," Angie said. "I want to bump this up to the winter list, and I think we can sell first serial to Red Book. The morning shows are going to love it. Gail King is going to go nuts. She and Nora will fight over it."
Madeline swallowed. She tried to imagine herself going on CBS this morning with Gail King, Nora O'Donnell, and Charlie Rose to discuss a novel she had written about Grace and Benton Co. "The thing is," Madeline said, "there would be a lot I'd have to change, because the stuff I have in there now hits a little close to home."
"Do you know someone who has gone through this?" Angie asked. She gasped. "You?"
"No, not me," Madeline said, although if it had been her going through it, she surely wouldn't want her best friend writing a novel about it.
"It's okay if it is you," Angie said. "Did I ever tell you about the guy who tiled my master bathroom? He was edible. I wanted to eat him."
Madeline closed her eyes. She could not believe she had started this ball rolling. All across America, Women would be admitting to having impure thoughts about their electricians and their plaster guys.
I definitely have to change the mint tea, Madeline said, and the pistachio macarons, and the plowman's lunch, and them dancing to the song Loving Cup. Normally I would say go right ahead, replace those details with equally vivid details, but in this case, Madeline, you really nailed it. Those details belong in there. You can't take out the mint tea. You can't take out the plowman's lunch. The way you describe the radishes and him feeding her, it's all too good to cut. It would be like Hemingway without the bullfights, or Cheever without the 624 to New Canaan.
Yes, but, Madeline said.
Just keep it as it is, Angie said. If we absolutely positively have to change stuff later, we will.
Okay, Madeline said uneasily.
And have you thought of an ending? Angie asked.
An ending?
I know you have issues with resolution, Angie said. But what I'd really like to see happen here is for B and G to end up together.
Madeline heard Angie slam a pen down on her desk.
I'm sick of women at the end of these novels doing the right thing. Sticking with their husbands, pandering to family values. Even 50 Shades of Grey played it safe. She huffed. I want an ending where the woman is happy instead of good.
Okay, Madeline said.
I can do that.
She was marginally more comfortable now that they were talking about the ending. Grace and Benton were still carrying on, so anything Madeline wrote would be wholly fictional.
Great, Angie said. This book is going to be a huge hit. I can feel it in my tooth fillings.
Thanks, Madeline said.
We need to come up with a title, Angie said. You don't have any ideas, do you?
I really haven't gotten that far, Madeline said. I kind of wrote it as a lark, or maybe more like a practice exercise.
A practice exercise. Oh, that's classic. It really is. This practice exercise is going right to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, Angie said. Don't worry about the title. I have people in-house for that. We'll brainstorm.
Okay, Madeline said.
I'll keep you in the loop, Angie said. We won't give your book a title without running it past you.
Right, Madeline said.
What are you doing on the phone with me? Angie said. Get writing.
What had she done? It was fiction, she reminded herself. Deep breath in, deep breath out. It was fiction. Brick wanted a car. There were bills to pay. She had rented this stupid apartment for $12,000. College was on the horizon. Trevor was 2,000 feet in the air. He was technically not even on the planet with her. She couldn't discuss any of this with Trevor anyway unless she told him Grace's secret. Two of the women at this table will betray the person on their left. Eddie had been to Grace's left. Grace had been to Madeline's left. So here it was then, her betrayal of Grace. No, Madeline wouldn't do it. But if Madeline pissed off Angie, Angie might nail her on breach of contract. Madeline might be forced by law to return the advance, most of which she'd already spent. As Madeline saw it, she had two options. She could write the novel about Grace and Benton, or she could default on her contract and return her advance money and write another novel down the road when she was ready. The morning shows were tempting, but no, she called Eddie again to ask for her $50,000 back. Nantucket. Thornton Bale, the paving king of Nantucket, who was resurfacing the parking lot of the Nantucket Yacht Club, overheard Eddie Panchik on his cell phone. The Nantucket Yacht Club was right across the street from the office of Island Fog Realty, and pretty much everyone in town knew that when Eddie was having a conversation he didn't want anyone else to hear, he headed across the street to the Yacht Club parking lot. What Thornton Bale overheard late in the afternoon of Memorial Day went something like this. Madeline, yes, I understand your dilemma. I understand, Madeline. I told you June, and if not June, then August. Madeline, if I could, I would. But I just can't right now. You have to be patient. I need you to hang in there. I need you to believe in me. There were two parties involved from the get-go. You knew there was risk. Yes, you did. Madeline, please, I need you to cut me some slack. I will make everything right, but I can't do it today. You have to give me time, Madeline. Please, just give me time. Well, he thought, that's interesting.
June.
Hope. She weathered the rumor about her screwing Brick by holding her head high and not saying one word on the topic. Allegro was back to walking with Brick between classes, making him late for everything because they stopped in front of every water fountain to kiss. Hope couldn't watch them without wanting to barf. Meanwhile, Allegro was still seeing Ian Coburn. She would tell Brick she was going to stay home and cram for finals, and tell her parents that she was going to wait at the end of the driveway for Hollis to pick her up for a study group, but instead it would be Ian Coburn in his red Camaro, whisking her away to study the fine art of giving a blowjob while watching the sun go down from a remote stretch of beach in Mattaquatcham. Hope should have just told Brick while she had the chance. Yes, Allegra is seeing Ian. Yes, Allegra is screwing Ian. Indeed, Hope was certain the reason the rumor about Hope and Brick died so quickly was because Allegra put her foot down and stomped it out. She knew Hope was capable of telling everyone about her and Ian Coburn. A less nourishing thought was that the rumor about Hope and Brick had fizzled because nobody in their right mind could imagine Brick wanting to have sex with Hope. Hope resumed believing that Allegra would blow it. She couldn't two-time all summer on this tiny island without getting caught. All Hope had to do was wait. But waiting was tedious. The school year was drawing to a close, and the weather had warmed up. By the end of the first week of June, Hope had aced all her exams. There was nothing left to study for, and no reason even to practice the flute. Her job at the rectory of St. Mary's Church would start right after school ended, but that would be a quiet, antisocial snooze. She would help Mrs. Aguiar file, and she would do some research for Father Declan's homilies. She would answer the phone and inform an endless string of visitors that masses were held Saturday at 5 p.m. and Sunday at 8:30, 10, and 11:30. There was weekday mass at 7:30 a.m., and there was a Spanish mass at 7 p.m. on Sunday. For now, when Hope came home from school, she would lie in the hammock, strung tightly between two elms, overlooking Pulpis Harbor, and she would read. Allegra was already heading to the beach with her friends every afternoon to drink the beer that Bluto's older sister bought for them and then pass out in the sand. Allegra never invited Hope to go, and Hope's friends were home reading in their own hammocks or getting a jump on their college application essays. Hope comforted herself with the knowledge that next spring she, Hope, would be getting into the University of Virginia and Vanderbilt, and maybe even Duke, while Allegra would be waitlisted at North Podunk Junior College. Still, it was lonely. The only bright spot in Hope's life was her talks with Benton about books. She had started with Goodbye Columbus, although it had struck her as old-fashioned and macho. She had liked Appointment in Samara much better. Benton had seemed really tickled that she was following his suggestions, and when he saw her, he made a point to ask her where she was in each book and how she was liking it. The conversations never lasted as long as Hope wanted because Hope's mother always interrupted, calling Benton over to the henhouse or needing his help with the lawnmower. Some days, Grace made Benton elaborate lunches, seared tuna Caesar salads or frisé au lardon topped with poached eggs. And there was always a basket of crusty rolls and a small wooden cutting board with cheese, crackers, sausage, mustard, butter, and Marcona almonds. Hope longed to be invited to join in these lunches, and she told her mother so. "This is an important time for Benton and me to talk," Grace said. "I'm sorry, darling. Would you like me to make you a ham sandwich?" "A ham sandwich?" Hope asked. "On a baguette, with sweet butter and fig jam?" Grace said. "You can eat it in the hammock while you read." That did sound enticing, but not quite as enticing as sitting down at the table with her mother and Benton. "I'd rather have salad with you guys," Hope said. "I'm sorry, darling," Grace said. "We have gardening issues to discuss." Gardening issues? Was her mother serious? She wasn't willing to include Hope in these lunches, despite her near constant pleas that both Hope and Allegra spend more time with her? "Fine," Hope said. "A ham sandwich is fine." Allegra's end-of-the-year grades were piss-poor. Low C's in chemistry, trig and American history, and a D in English. But a 79 in chorus, which she pointed out, was nearly a B. The grade in chorus was impressive, Hope thought, since Allegra couldn't carry a tune to save her life. In an uncharacteristic display of backbone, Eddie informed Allegra that she would not have driving privileges for the summer. This was okay when she was out with Ian Coburn in the red Camaro, but to Seabrick, she either needed to take the shuttle, which came out to the Pulpus Road only 3 times daily, or she had to beg Hope for a ride. Hope agreed to chauffeur more than she might have, if only to see Brick. Brick seemed miserable. He was working part-time at Nantucket Bank as an information assistant, which he announced was the dullest of indoor jobs. He greeted people. He directed them either left, toward the tellers, or right, toward the loan officers. He was also in charge of showing people how to use the penny arcade, which sorted and counted change and spat out a receipt that customers could trade in for paper money. Brick looked bloated and pale. He had lost the luster and verve he'd possessed only a few weeks earlier. There was a full week of graduation parties, and Allegra and Brick were invited to all of them. Hope wasn't invited to any, although whenever they pulled in the driveway, Brick would say, "Why don't you come in for a while, Hope?" "No, thank you," Hope said. At more than one of the parties, Ian Coburn's red Camaro was already parked out front. And Hope thought, how does she pull this off on a nightly basis? One day when Benton was working in the rosebed, Hope ostentatiously threw herself across the hammock, brandishing the copy of Lolita that she had recently purchased. She opened the book with a loud sigh, hoping Benton would notice her. But for a long time, he was consumed with cutting back the roses. "Ow!" Benton said. He'd hit a thorn. "Are you okay?" Hope asked. She was up and out of the hammock in a flash. "Do you want me to get you a Band-Aid?" "Oh, Hope," Benton said. "I didn't see you there. You're quiet as a mouse." He then noticed Hope's book. "Hey, you're reading Lolita." Hope blushed. "Yep." Benton stepped out of the rosebed and wiped at his forehead with an orange bandana. "I keep promising to get you that list of 100 books, but I've been so busy." "You have clients other than Mom, right?" Hope said. "Right," Benton said. "I work on 6 projects at a time." "You have 5 other clients? Hope asked. "It feels like you're always here." "Well," he said, gazing back at the house, "this one is my personal favorite. And I have a manager and 10 college kids working for me." "I don't understand why you're a gardener if you were a literature major," Hope said. Benton laughed. "Life happens, Hope. I was on a work-study scholarship at Ohio State, and they put me on the grounds crew. I liked it. When I graduated, it was more appealing to me to work outside with yards and gardens, parks, green spaces. It's not that I don't dream of being an English teacher someday, I sort of do. But I guess I just prefer this kind of work." "Did you read all the time when you were a teenager?" Hope asked. "I read secretly," Benton said. "Late at night. During the day, I did regular teenage stuff. I played rugby, I drank beer in the woods with my bozo friends." "You were sort of a combination of me and Allegra," Hope said. "Maybe," Benton said. "I don't really know your sister." Hope felt happy about this. Most people liked Allegra better because she was outgoing, like Eddie. She could converse, tease, flirt, and make instant friends. If Benton met Allegra, he would prefer Allegra, or so Hope feared. But maybe not. Allegra wouldn't tolerate a long discussion about books. "She's nothing like me," Hope said. "She's beautiful and shallow." Benton didn't flinch at this assessment. "You're beautiful," he said. Hope shrugged. She could tell when someone was saying this just to be nice. "She's more beautiful. She and her best friend Hollis are the most popular girls in the school. Allegra has been dating Brick Llewellyn since the start of sophomore year. But now she's bored with him. But instead of just breaking up with him, she's been hanging out with this kid named Ian who goes to BC. "BC," Benton said. "Good school." Clearly, Benton hadn't heard Eddie's joke. "She's not cheating on him," Hope said quickly. As much as she was aching for Allegra to get her comeuppance, she couldn't seem to be the one to turn her in. "But she isn't being very nice." "And that bothers you?" Benton said. "I want her to act like a decent human being," Hope said. She wished all this sounded less like an episode of Degrassi and more like painful, complicated real life. "Do you have any advice?" "Actually," Benton said, "I do. At that moment, Grace poked her head out the back sliding door. She seemed delighted to see Hope and Benton talking.
"Benton," she said, "lunch is ready."
To Hope, she said, "Honey, would you like a ham sandwich?" Hope shrugged. As always, her mother ruined everything.
"I guess," she said.
Grace. Just when she thought life couldn't get any better, she received a phone call from Hester Phan.
"I have exciting news," Hester said.
Hester was a serious Vietnamese-American woman with a deadpan voice. She sounded as if she were calling to tell Grace that there was a sale on rubber gloves at the Stop and Shop.
"You do?" Grace said.
"The home and garden editor of the Boston Globe loved the photos. They want to do a feature in the Sunday paper."
Grace shrieked.
"When?" she said.
"They're sending a writer and photographer on July 21st, Hester said, "to run 5 days later on Sunday the 26th.
They had less than a month to get ready.
"Woo-hoo," Grace said. "Thank you, Hester. Thank you."
"That's my job," Hester said. "I'll call closer to the date with the exact details, and I'll send Eddie my final bill."
Grace hung up. She didn't know whether to call Eddie or Benton first. The right thing to do was to call Eddie. This was his house, and he was paying Hester's fee. Besides, she wanted to tell Benton in person. She said, "You're not going to believe this. The Boston Globe said yes.
The Sunday Boston Globe?"
"Yes to what?" Eddie said.
"Yes to the gardening feature," Grace said.
"Oh, right, right," Eddie said. "Does this mean I can stop paying Hester?"
"After the final bill," Grace said, "which I think we agreed includes a success bonus."
"Why should she get a bonus for success?" Eddie said. "It's her job. She should succeed as a matter of course, not get a bonus for it."
He sounded like he was in some kind of cavern. His voice was reverberating and Grace could hear his footsteps. "Where are you?" she said.
"Number 13, Eagle Wing Lane," he said.
"It sounds empty," Grace said. "Aren't there supposed to be guys working?"
"Yes," Eddie said. "There are supposed to be guys working."
She couldn't decipher the tone of his voice. Was he being sarcastic? She didn't care. She was too excited about the Sunday Boston Globe. She said, "Honey, aren't you happy for me?"
"Thrilled," Eddie said.
Grace hung up. Eddie didn't sound thrilled. But what had she expected? She wished the girls were home. But Hope had started her job at the church rectory, and Allegra was off island at her new SAT prep course. Instead of once a week for 6 weeks, this class met every day for a week, including Saturday. Allegra needed yet another prep class because the other class had resulted in only a 30-point increase in her critical reading score, and her math score had stayed the same. Neither score was very high. Eddie wasn't happy about spending money on another class, in addition to the cost of flying her back and forth. Grace said that some people just didn't test well. Eddie said she wasn't trying. Had Grace ever seen her studying? No, Grace had not seen Allegra studying, and furthermore, Allegra was out every single night. Grace would tell the girls about the Sunday Boston Globe that evening at dinner. Would they care? Grace wanted to call Madeline, but Madeline had been very busy writing her new novel at the apartment, and Grace didn't want to interrupt her. However, she was too excited to keep the news to herself, and it was still half an hour until Benton would arrive. Grace sent Madeline a text. "Sunday, Boston Globe, featuring My Garden, July 26th. Madeline texted back, "Great." Grace tried not to feel deflated. "Great" was an appropriate response. She couldn't expect anyone to understand how far beyond great this was. Grace pulled the cork from a bottle of vintage Veuve Clicquot that she had found down in Eddie's wine fridge, just as Benton rounded the corner of the house.
"Champagne?" he said. "What happened to mint tea?"
Grace poured two glasses but left them on the table. She said, "Hester Phan called." He said, "Break it to me gently." She said, "On Sunday, July 26th, we are going to be featured in the Boston Globe." Benton swung her in a circle and let out a cowboy rodeo whoop. This was the reaction Grace had been craving. As Benton took her face in his hands and started to kiss her,
She marveled at how it felt to have someone in her life who shared her passion for this yard, and who was just as over the moon about this feature as she was. A partner, a friend, and more. Benton pulled Grace by the hand toward the garden shed, leaving their champagne in the sun. The following day, Grace received an invitation to the Nantucket Garden Club's Sunset Soiree. This year's soiree was being held at Jean Burton's home, which Grace had always thought of as the house of 1,000 koi ponds, really only 5, but for Grace that was 5 too many. Jean was president of the Nantucket Garden Club. She had taken over for Grace when Grace's term ended. Jean was a native Texan, filled with charm and hospitality. She continued to call Grace for advice and help with logistics, and she kept Grace in the loop even though Grace had become consumed with her own project. Grace had been president for 6 years and had hosted the Sunset Soiree in her own yard years earlier at their old house on Dover Street. The Sunset Soiree was a fabulous event, and for all the years Grace was involved, she had brought Madeline as her date. But this year, she thought, she would take Benton. She called Madeline to see what she thought. "What if I took Benton to the Sunset Soiree?" Grace asked. "Would you be mad?" Madeline was silent, but in the background Grace could hear the sound of her pen scratching against paper as well as the hum of her laptop. "I won't be mad," Madeline said. "I like the Sunset Soiree just fine. The gardens are pretty, the food is good, but it's really your thing. I just don't want you to think I'm ditching you for Benton," Grace said. "That's not the problem," Madeline said. "The problem is you being seen in public with Benton." Yes, Grace had considered this, and yet she really wanted to venture out in the wider world with Benton. The island was 4 miles wide by 13 miles long. They couldn't exactly go to dinner at the Ship's Inn or walk the Sconset Bluff hand in hand. The Sunset Soiree was a garden club function. Benton was her landscape architect, and they had something to jointly brag about. Grace couldn't wait to tell Jean Burton and Susan Prendergast and Monica Del Rey about the Sunday Boston Globe. The Sunset Soiree would be a safe and appropriate place for her and Benton to go together. "I'll ask Eddie's permission," Grace said. "I'm sure he'll say yes." "I'm sure he will say yes," Madeline said. She sighed. "But you know how those women talk, Grace. Remember how blonde Sharon made such a big deal when Monica showed up in the mismatched Chanel flats? She accused Monica of being drunk when she got dressed, and 3 days later everyone had her checking into Betty Ford. Those women are vipers. They're ruthless. If you go with Benton, they'll have a field day with it." "Blonde Sharon can kiss my ass," Grace said. "You can do what you want," Madeline said. "But as your best friend, I have to tell you I would feel much better about you going with Benton if the two of you weren't..." "I know," Grace said, and she